Hello and welcome to episode 19 of the Precision Microcast. Today, Josh and I will be talking about his recent trip to NS Tool in Japan, as well as our precision problems.
On this week's history segment, we're going to talk about a company called NS Tool. And NS Tool is a ultra-high-end carbide end mill and drill producer located in Japan. And I had the fortune of visiting the factory last month in Japan, where I toured their manufacturing facility and their R&D center. And this segment's going to be a bit like a foreign correspondent report. When I pitched the idea to Adam, he seemed to like it. And I had this lofty vision of recording from the hotel room and making it like even more foreign correspondent. But here we are almost a month later, and it's given me a lot of time to reflect on the few days I spent with NS. And there's some really, really fascinating takeaways that I've gleaned. And a lot of them are general in the space of like high-end Japanese mold tools and what that niche represents, but then a lot of them are more specific to what NS represents. So before we kick things off, I think it might be good to establish sort of one of the key strengths of this specific niche of tool, and I really want to hone in on that. NS make a very, very niche type of tool. They specialize in micro end mills, so things, you know, below 6 millimeters in diameter and well below 6 millimeters. They make a 10 micron end mill. That's a bit mind blowing to wrap your head around. But one of their sort of main strengths is what I like to call a mold tool. And I think Adam might have a different word for it or a similar word for it. But Adam, maybe you can explain how these tools are used in practice.
So we call them a die tool in this shop. Oh. So the core concept is you're only cutting on a very localized point near the tip. If it's a ball end mill, it could be, you know, the entire radius, anywhere along that. But if it's a necked corner radius end mill, you're really just kind of cutting on the corner. And what that gives you is extremely low cutting pressure and deflections, and you can get very, very accurate wall surfaces with those necked end mills. And you can also get some really nice surface finishes. The trade-off is you're going to take a lot of steps downward in Z-axis. It's going to be a lot more cycle time, but you can really accomplish some amazing things.
Yeah, that's a great, great explanation. And just to add, like this, as the name sort of mold, or in your case, die tools, as the name suggests, these tools are for cutting hard materials. So you might see a lot of these tools acting in steels above 50 Rockwell.
Yeah. And so like, I use both NS and Union, but, oftentimes I'm going to them for extremely soft materials as well. NS makes a tool for resin that I've started using. And it does really amazing things. They just seem to do exceptionally well in niche scenarios as a toolmaker. Probably not something I would get for like roughing mild steel though. That's not the solution provider I'm going to look at first.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's an interesting point in regards to like the USP. It's a technically challenging USP to make a tool that has low deflection and has a very, very accurate geometry, but that also drives the costs, so that's why it's an expensive USP. You'll struggle, I think, at least, you'll struggle to make money using this tool for roughing, and it's, in that case, for me at least, in my daily use, it gets relegated as a finishing tool for high-precision features that demand the best quality tool, and so you pay a premium for that, but you get possibly some of the best cutting tools on the planet.
And what I really enjoy with either NS or Union or any higher end mold and die tool is the process consistency. So I do run some higher production numbers with both brands, and just the amount of consistency, not just on the cutting end, but the tapered area of the end mill, the neck, you can rely on those things to not change ever. I think everybody's had kind of a situation where the end mill may be a little bit longer than the advertised length of cut. You know, say it's 10 millimeters, but it's really pushing 11. And you take advantage of that sometimes. And then all of a sudden, the next end mill doesn't have that. And you can get yourself into a little trouble there if you have like a tool whose actual length kind of varies. And just having something where it's spot on every time makes my job a lot easier, a lot more predictable.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've got like anecdotes and anecdotes of how these types of tools, like, you know, they find themselves, they worm themselves into processes that no normal end mill would. Like, we have some tools that, like a 0.8 end mill that we use for a lot of watch parts, and a lot of, maybe not exactly the same part number, but similar cutting features. And we know that that 0.8 end mill is nearly always going to be about 18 to 22 microns undersize. And that's just the way it comes from the factory. It measures like a 0.39 millimeter radius. And we have finishing strategies that take into account that there's always going to be about 10 microns radially left on a wall, and that'll be enough for us to finish. And along comes, you know, a time where we either like run out of stock on the 0.8 end mill and we have to switch to like a sort of more generic brand. And you put the tool in and all the parts come out different. And it's not like, yes, you could have compensated for that, but the fact that 4 years after the original purchase date, and then you buy a second batch of these tools 4 years later, the fact that they're identical in diameter within a few microns allows you to build these processes much more confidently. And the same can be said to like a ball radius or a length, overall length of a tool, and so on and so on.
My one gripe is because oftentimes these tools are made with the idea of doing long stick out work. They sometimes have an unfortunately long shank. And so if you're using a very small HSK holder, you don't often have all that much shank depth in the holder. So I spend a lot of time just clipping shanks down to size. It's better than not having that shank length when you need it. It is very peculiar to get like a micro end mill and you look at the shank and it's like 75 millimeters or 3 inches long.
Yeah.
It's, Union offers now a short shank series, but, they don't quite have the sheer range and offerings and size and shape. So, that's just, I don't know, par for course, I guess, something you deal with when you get into a cutter series like this.
So, as I said, I spent a little bit of time in Japan touring the NS factory, and they were gracious enough to have me. And there were some like key takeaways that that underpin every single part of the process, the end mill manufacturing process that I saw. And I'd say the most important takeaway is like their unwavering total commitment to quality. And that's represented in every single step of the process, from like raw material in to final product out. And I'm sure that's actually quite comparable to many end mill manufacturers, but it was just very, very in your face in a good way of how committed NS was to their quality. And there's a lot of examples. Like, and I think one of the best ways to sort of describe that is give you like a virtual tour through the factory. And I was also lucky enough, as a sidebar, I was lucky enough to film a lot of this stuff as well. So very shortly, you'll see like a bit of a maybe unnarrated short documentary of how all these tools are made. But the only thing NS doesn't do is like the initial carbide pressing of the tool. Of the carbide. So the carbide blank is made by a supplier they have like a strategic relationship with in Japan. And from there, they handle everything in-house, from like prepping and doing the centerless grinding of the shank to making their own grinding machine, CNC grinding machine, called the TGM, which is a tool grinding machine. I found that quite funny. And all the way to like measurement report and calibration of each of the tools, to coating, to laser mark, like everything is done in-house to try to maintain all this quality. And as you know, as you assume, the end mill starts as a shank of carbide that has nothing ground into it. And what was quite surprising to me is how much emphasis, like we were going through this tour and the first station is this centerless grinding sort of cell. And they like stopped and said, this is the most important part of the entire process. And that was quite, it was like quite confronting because I didn't assume that it would play such a big deal in the grinding process. But it makes sense the more you think about it. If you have like a 4 millimeter shank tool and you have a shank tolerance of plus zero minus 10 microns, that shank, as it enters the whole production process, if it's 10 microns undersize, it has a very different effect on what the tool cutting geometry is going to be compared to a shank going through the process that has -1 micron of tolerance, or it's, you know, 3.999 millimeters. Where the tangency points on the ball to straight walled cutting edge are will be different. The runout of the tool will be different. The collets that grab onto these shanks during the grinding process have to collapse a little bit more. The shrink fit holders that you put these slightly more undersized or slightly less undersized tools into have to shrink down more or less. And all of this starts to affect the way the tool behaves. So NS, what they've done, which I thought was quite amazing, is that they've standardized the entire production of their entire catalog range to a ±1 micron tolerance on the shank, which is really wild. That's insane, because on the catalogs they still say like H4 tolerance, which is a much bigger spec. But on a 4mm tool, you're looking at 3.998 ±1 micron for their entire range.
That's pretty astonishing in terms of tightness. But one of the things in America, I'm often trying to tell people that they really probably need to consider going to metric shank tooling. Just because of the doors it opens in terms of tool quality. But there's also a huge benefit. Most of the higher end mold tools, they're either 4 or 6 millimeter shank. And so all of a sudden my tool holding library, I have to have way less collets. I just have a huge concentration of 4 and 6 millimeter collets or hydraulic sleeves. And in some cases, heat shrink holders. And I feel like I just have less stuff, less tool holder stuff associated with it when you look at, like, say, an inch shank system.
And there's an ecosystem around it as well. It's like what you've alluded to. You have specific holders in that 4 and 6 millimeter size made by Japanese and American and German tool holding companies that have ultra low runout spec, and they're sort of designed around these 4 and 6 millimeter shank carbide tools or high end carbide tools. So one other spec that blew my mind when it came to the shank tolerance was the cylindricity of the tool. So the diameter is obviously important, but if you can imagine a tool that's within the diameter tolerance but is wedge shaped or tapered, that can cause more problems than a tool that's really, really cylindrical but just slightly undersized. And so they have a cylindricity spec of 0.2 microns on these shanks, which is also quite mind-blowing because that's well within like gauge territory, to the extent that in-house we actually use like old end mills from these high-end tool grinders as like gauge support devices. If you've got something that, like a V, for example, that needs to be measured very, very accurately, you can use these shanks with complete confidence. So the cylindricity spec is also really brutal because it covers like taper, covers roundness, covers all these like slightly more abstract tolerances that you can't necessarily gauge with a micrometer or just with a micrometer. But they control it in process one at a time, every single tool they grind. So once the centerless grinding is done, they move to a station where they put these chamfers on both ends of the tool. And at first glance, it seems like quite simple, just putting a chamfer on the back of a tool, but it's critical for the processing of the tools, but also of the tool and its use at the end customer. So these chamfers, you know, they have to be firstly burr free, and they have to be very, very consistent. The burrs obviously cause problems for the process, like in process work for the grinding of the tools. If you've got a burr on the end of your tool and you try to put it into a very, very nicely ground collet, suddenly all that work that you've gone to create a cylindrical and round and accurate shank goes out the window. So that, you know, each of these cells as we're moving through the factory has a defined purpose. And I absolutely love this, and I wish we did this in our workshop more and more, but at every single station, whether it be like a measuring station or a centerless grinding station or a chamfering station, laser marking station, they have like a laminated A4, A3 sheet with what is a good tool and what's like a good product or a good part of the process and what's a bad one. So just for visual inspection, every single operator in these cells is constantly being recalibrated visually. And your eyes are very powerful at identifying if something looks strange or not, especially when you aid them with something like a microscope or a profile projector. Your eyes can often pick up way quicker than what a digital readout or an overlay can aid you with. So this constant recalibration is, you know, you can have the best grinding machines and laser marking machines in the world, but this constant visual recalibration is so useful to maintain some stable quality.
That is a fairly good idea, in my opinion. It's interesting to see like how stuff like that can kind of creep if you don't have a zero point to reference back to. Employees change hands, or you know, somebody retires, and the people who understood why the original accuracy and burrness shape and all that, that tribal knowledge goes away, where just a simple photo kind of maintaining what it needs to be probably helps maintain the quality.
Yeah, absolutely. And we see echoes of that in watchmaking as well, like with decoration of components. You'll get one person polishing something and it will be polished, right? It'll look shiny or have a certain RA. I mean, watchmakers never really measure RA, but it'll fall within the confines of what the drawing is. But when you compare it to a lot that was done by someone else, it's not the same. Maybe something's radiused over a little bit more, or the lay of the polishing, the direction is in one direction versus another. And someone had to make that PDF and print it out and laminate it and take the photos and establish the process. And often that's like the most painful part of establishing a process. Like it's not creating any value by hiring an engineer to do that in that moment, but it enables like stable quality production. And it's a big takeaway, I think, for me more broadly.
Somebody's got to make the bad part as the example too. That's where I come in.
After the chamfering, there's a step which, again, seems so insignificant, which is like the laser marking of the shank. And they do this before the shank is actually necked and then the flutes are ground and coated and so on. It's really, really early in the process, which I thought was quite interesting. But laser marking is so, so particular because often I find, especially with economy tools or economy price tools, the laser marking
messes up the shank.
Oh, yeah.
Big time. That drives me nuts. I have a little aluminum split clothespin lap just to like dust the marking off. It's a huge issue. They need to stop doing it.
Yeah, exactly. And I sort of like saw the laser marking machine and I said, do you guys know about the burr? And they're like, yeah, of course we know about the burr. And I felt very silly in that moment. But you look at the laser marking and it's done with like an ultra high-end laser. It's not done with like some cheap CO2 laser. The marking is like, it is like a banknote quality. It's throwing holograms, you know? And you can grab an NS tool and put it straight into like an ultra tight shrink fit holder or a hydraulic holder or a RegoFix holder and you will not feel it.
Yeah, I remember when I first encountered that as like a young machinist, it was roll stamped marked drill bits. And like I was shown how to like stone the stamping height off of the drill bit so it'd run truer. Mm. And I was like, why don't we just get laser marked drill bits? And it's like, oh, that's kind of another can of worms. And, you know, really no way to win that one. But it sounds like, you know, you spend enough money on your laser system and the problem goes away. But
yeah. But it's also interesting that they do it so early in the process. Like when they do in-process measurement and they're, you know, rolling this carbide end mill against some Vs, any irregularities of the laser marking would show up as out of roundness or like diameters being thrown off during the process. And so if you do the laser marking at the very, very end, like, yeah, it might be fine, but unless you have like a something after the laser marking to make sure that it's fine, then you won't really know if it's okay. But if you do it right at the start and you're constantly checking in the process, you have a guarantee that the laser marking is not causing any issues.
That makes a lot of sense.
So, you know, at this stage, we've talked a lot about how carbide shanks are made. But the next bits about the process, you know, it's very difficult to explain in a podcast format. Maybe we'll chuck some photos up on the Instagram as visual aids, but the grinding process, and by no means am I a tool grinding expert. In fact, I know very little about tool grinding. And the more I learn, especially with like a tool like this, the more I realize I don't know. But they've spent an inordinate amount of time perfecting their process to achieve a level of stability that I thought was really incredible. Throughout the entire tool grinding facility, where they've got all these tool grinding machines, they have TV screens that are tracking the live measurements one at a time that are coming off of these grinders, off the tools. So for example, you'll have a rolling chart. So maybe, I don't know, let's say 50 machines in the whole factory or more. And each one's doing a specific type of tool, and you'll have a chart with the tool name, the batch number, the date, and then the statistical analysis of the tool diameter. And what was amazing is that you have this big band that's like centered around a nominal value. Let's say it's a 1 millimeter end mill, and it's measuring the radius of 0.5 millimeter. You might have a catalog tolerance of ±15 microns. And so it's centered around that middle point. And then you have a second band that's only ±2 microns of width, which is the internal goal of what this tool grinding company wants to achieve. And every single dot in that statistical process analysis graph is in smack bang in the middle of that ±2 micron band. And they could easily let the machines like warm up and cool down and shift start and shift end, and these end mills would probably all still be in tolerance, but 5 microns this way, 5 microns that way. But for them, the stability is like the most important thing. And for me as a consumer, I feel that when I put that 0.8 end mill in and I've dictated an entire process around it, I actually see the measurement on my laser and I see the measurement on my part and reap the benefit of that level of stability.
I enjoy it too. Just saves me a lot of time just knowing that I can oftentimes drop a tool in and continue on making parts, and no new test cuts or sneaking back up on size. Just it's a huge time saver for a guy like me.
So a lot of this will be explained more visually in the Instagram photos and this sort of short little doco on how these end mills are produced. But there will, tying into this key takeaway of stability, in their sort of final inspection department, there's two things that really stood out. The first is they do a 100% in-process inspection at multiple points. The first point being straight after the grinding process. So one at a time, each tool, as it exits the grinding machine, goes into a measurement station. The measurement station reads the diameter of the tool and any other features of the tool, feeds it straight back into the grinding machine. The grinding machine does its offsets, and the next tool comes in. So the feedback loop's incredibly short. But after grinding, you might have a coating process, for example. Not every tool is raw carbide. So after the coating process, they have another 100% inspection station where they're measuring things like the roundness of the ball or the diameter of the ball, the tangency point between the ball and where it goes parallel with the axis of the tool. All these things get measured. And if you want, you can actually request a measurement report for these tools. So if you have an application where you're cutting, for example, a very, very accurate silicon injection mold where you need to have mating surfaces that are realistically in the plus or minus 2 micron range and a 3D freeform surface, you really care about the radius of your ball, and the fact, and the radius should be consistent and non-wavy across the whole ball. And you might even go so far to model the actual radius in your cam rather than using a ball, like a generic ball size, and then doing some offsets in the control. You might say, okay, this is a, let's call it a 1 millimeter ball. It's actually 0.998 millimeters, modeling that into your cam and so on. And these reports, you can purchase them. And to me, that's just the next level, because suddenly you have to keep track of this end mill through the entire process. It has to have some sort of serialization that ties it to this report. And I was like pleasantly surprised that they offer that as a service.
That's what I have to do with the carbide milling with ball mills. Not so much like something like a 6C tool, but the coated variety like I get from Union, the coating is so thick that it's hard to control to like a single digit micron tolerance. And so there's always some give on how true the size of the ball actually is. So you, each one has a report and you just update your cam appropriately, which I don't love. If you're like on a long stretch of parts, like you're constantly messing around with that. But yeah, it's some of the form work I do, it is needed.
Earlier on, I touched on NS making their own grinding machine. And I thought this was a really interesting story, like in their pursuit of this mindset of constant quality and stable quality. They found that the grinding machines that were available on the market to purchase were pretty much too difficult to integrate into their workflow. Especially because a lot of these machines are made in Switzerland and Swiss Japanese language barrier. I mean, it's hard enough talking to French people as an English person. As a Japanese person, it might be like a very, very difficult chasm to cross. So they in-house the entire machine tool building process where they designed these machines catered so specifically and nichely for their micro end mill grinding production. And these tool grinding machines, they have tens and tens, like I don't know the exact number, but almost 100, I would say, of these machines that are running 24/7 in some cases, making these tools. And some are dedicated for necking processes where they're like pinch and peel grinding the necks. Some are dedicated to like radius grinding for the ball mills. Some are dedicated to these like bullnose mills where you have wall, sort of these back tapered fluted tools with a radius and then into a flat section. And each of these tools are designed around an end product, where I think with many grinding machines that you could buy straight off the market, they have to be by design sort of one fit all solutions. Even if it's a dedicated micro end mill grinding machine, it's still going to be doing ball mills and this drills and like bullnose mills and so on and so on. But these machines that NS is designing in-house are dedicated for one specific process.
That's always been curious to me. You see a little bit of this in Union as well, where there is both for in-house, but also Union sells these machines, some special machine building going on around their carbide tool products. And that's just very, very curious to me. Like, I imagine, you know, the first few or even first dozen building your own grinding experiences are rough, but once you get to, say, grinder 100, that's they probably have gleaned a lot of insights. But the stuff I find interesting about Union is they're not only a end mill company, they do a lot of PCB drilling, and they have like a huge apparatus of machinery around the PCB drilling. So PCB drills often get like a collar put on them. And so when the machine picks it up, that sets the depth. And so they have like little machines that can automatically install the collar on their drills. They have measuring machines. They have this really cool runout system where it could dynamically check the runout in the machine as it's rotating. It's interesting to see not just the cutter, but the stuff that comes along with it.
Yeah, like that runout machine, it was to some crazy high RPM.
Many hundreds of thousands.
Which is so wild, and I guess speaks to an ecosystem that these tools end up going into. Like that carbide PCB runout, PCB drilled runout measuring machine is probably dedicated for just one thing, which is PCB drilling machines. And there's enough of a market for them to not just make the drills, but also the measuring apparatus as well.
Well, one thing I continually learn, like looking at machine tools, is the high accuracy, like world of tooling, is generally not anyone's ideal customer. Like machine tool builders very seldomly are building for the tool and die market. They're building for a lot of other markets that they might also cater to the tool and die market. And I imagine cutting tools the same way. You know, why limit yourself to just grumpy tool makers when you can have the electronics world as well?
Tool makers can't get grumpy.
No.
So to wrap up, I guess, the foreign correspondent report, I mean, there's so much more that was seen and observed and so on. But a lot of that, I guess, you guys will see in a short little doco that will come out. But to wrap it up, I think one of the key takeaways that I want you guys as listeners to hear is that high-end cutting tools are so distant from your day-to-day cutting tool, both in terms of their application as well as their manufacturing. I think a lot of these tools, they have such high demands put on them by their end users. Like you might have to mill a cavity to a very like a single digit micron tolerance in size. A normal tool is just not up to the task of doing that repeatedly. And because of the very, very high demand that these tools are exposed to, the manufacturing process of the tool has to be tuned as well. So using something like an NS tool for roughing, you know, XYZ material, they make a tool for that as well. But it's like taking your Ferrari four-wheel driving. And I think it's possible to take a Ferrari four-wheel driving, but Ferrari is really good around the track.
You know, from my perspective, I do some roughing with a couple of the Union things I have. And they do it quite well. It's just I can't push that shop-wide. I can't use it for all the parts I make. Like if I have a big block of pre-hard tool steel that has a lot of metal coming off of it, I'm probably going to go with an American-made offering that has a lot better value per pound of chips removed. But then I'll finish it more than likely with the Union. It just, the end mill cost is just too high for me to justify throwing money at it to rough with. But I also, I don't know, I don't have the machines that could really push an end mill to its limits and, you know, get those dollars out of it. But that could be another factor. You know, if you have a better roughing machine, you could really take advantage of an end mill's properties. Maybe it's worth it.
So, Adam.
Yeah?
What was your precision problem this week?
Well, I was on vacation, but let's say this month, we had a grinding project come up where the basic part was kind of like a square tube, a square with a square hole down the middle. The customer had some leeway for how that could all be assembled, but it needed to be ground. And originally, they came to me with kind of a U-shape and a flat cap. And so I would grind like the bottom of the U and the sidewalls. That represented a challenge because it was a lot of sidewall engagement and getting the accuracy they wanted. And side wheel grinding does leave that beautiful crosshatch, and that can be beneficial in a lot of ways. But I kind of thought for their application, it might be weird to have two flat ground with the bottom of the wheel surfaces and two crosshatched surfaces that this was riding on. And my interpretation was that they'd be better served with having four surfaces of the same grind pattern. So I talked them into just approaching this as, instead of a U-shape with a cap, maybe it's two L shapes and we connect at the corners. And what that allowed me to do was I match ground both shapes of the L's. And basically you just flip one around and spin it and then connect them together, and that makes your square. But from a grinding perspective, what it allowed me to do is I could grind the top of the L, move down and grind the lower foot of the L, and that spacing set the inside dimension of the square that we are going to construct. And relying on the grinder to move down an accurate amount, for me, is always a very, very safe play. That's a very, very good way to get high accuracy parts. The only limiting factor there is the squareness has to be really spot on, but that's not something I really struggle with generally. I have a good system of measuring, and I have a lot of tooling to approach squareness like that. So, overall, I was very pleased with that process. I got nice squareness, nice surface finishes. I was able to make very accurate internal dimensions on that square hole when assembled. And so, I kind of patted myself on the back when I pulled that one off. And yours?
My precision problem was tool related. We had a project come through on the NH Micro side where we had to create some rather precise bores of different sizes in some copper. And there was enough volume and enough meat in the project to go with a dedicated hole-making solution. So we contacted a Swiss company, tool-making company, to manufacture some reamers for us out of their catalog, really. But they have reamers in like 2 micron increments. And so we purchased some reamers that would hit the tolerance of the hole perfectly, and the drills to suit. So the pre-drills and the reamers, these carbide reamers, to create like a, I think the hole size was around 1.5 millimeters with a plus or minus 5 micron tolerance, roughly. And we had maybe 5 or 6 different sizes of this very, very similar hole size. Probably biggest was about like 1.8 millimeters and the smallest was around 1.5. So we bought this suite of reamers that would allow us to complete the task fairly quickly because the bores were fairly deep as well, and interpolating such a hole would be a bit of a nightmare. dealing with taper and also like toolware and copper is no joke. So the reamer seemed like a really, really sound solution. So we go to set the parts up and do, you know, some test holes before we start attacking the part, and we notice that the holes are reaming oversize, and you know, it's not a huge problem. Like, reamers are a bit tricky and you might have to like dial them in a little bit. But we realize as well, simultaneously, the drills are on a 2mm shank, which is a bit challenging to hold on to with the PG-15 system, the RegoFix system, because the minimum collet size is 3mm on those on that system. So we had to bust out these ER collet holders, and as good as ER collet holders are, they're not perfect, and maybe some run out in the drill can cause some issues. And so we started troubleshooting that. But we quickly realized that none of that was causing any issues. Our holes were just chronically 15 microns oversized, no matter what we tried. And, you know, after like a whole day of basically screwing around, trying to dial these reamers in, we just do the sanity check and use the laser to measure the diameter of the reamer. And sure enough, it's 15 microns oversized as well. And so it's the precision problem was in the operator, in us, not really checking the most obvious cause and sort of making a few assumptions that all your tools are going to be perfect. And so, yeah, it left a bit of an annoying taste in our mouths for reaming and copper. But realistically, it was all, there were perfect holes, just exactly 15 microns out from the tool.
Yeah, that's it always hurts when it ends up being something like that, because you're just so programmed that your problem that you're trying to solve is just going to be a much bigger problem. It's, you know, you get in the habit of not checking the really obvious stuff sometimes. But yeah, it'll get you.
Well, especially with like that part that we were doing, that was by far the easiest feature on the part. Like, there was 100 other things that could have gone wrong that just like went without a hitch, and just a couple of holes. Yeah, very annoying. How often, Adam, do you get like a chance to guide the design? I mean, you know, you said in your interpretation of the problem, with a scenario like that, you've obviously tailored it to your tools and your workflow, so you get the maximum result. How often do you get that opportunity?
With certain customers, that's quite often, I would say. But they're usually developing something, whether it's like tooling for their process, or maybe I'm making something that contributes to the end part. So they don't necessarily know what they need yet, and they just kind of want to reach out to the guy that's helping them make it and try to either get cost down or get quality up. Like, you know as well as I do, there's certain things you could do to get a lot of quality for free, where you're not going to have nearly as many problems. It's going to go quicker. And so these customers always kind of just, we'll ask. It's usually, I try to give them a quick answer. You know, they're probably in the design phase. I don't want to hold them up. But also, I don't want to dump a bunch of time into, I don't want to make that a habit. You know, you're seldom getting paid for that input. But if I can, you know, spend 10 minutes, make a quick CAD sketch and solve their problem, make life a little easier for myself, and, you know, they grow to have value in that relationship, I think it's worth doing. But you do have to kind of put a limit on how much of that you'll do. I have other customers, though, who I start to kind of feel a little taken advantage of. You know, they might really try to push a little few too many decisions my way. And it's like, hey, I'm making the parts. I can give you a little input. But at a certain point, you start to feel like you're doing their job for them or not being rewarded for that. But
well, yeah, that's sort of where I... It's a bit of a leading question, because I was expecting you to say something like that. That fine balance of offering a tweak versus generating like way too much value that you're not getting paid for is...
And you also have to be careful. Like, I have a few customers, like I might see the problem, but I've learned, having dealt with them, like some people take, even if they ask, is there anything we could change to make this easier? They don't handle the suggestion well sometimes. They view it as a criticism. And so I just kind of, you know, have a little flag on their contact and, you know, so it looks good to me. And I, you know, I enjoy the relationship otherwise, but I've learned like, well, okay, that he doesn't, he's not looking for much here other than validation. And so I can give him the thumbs up.
Well, it's interesting because we do design and manufacturing for our own product. And even in a small organization where we have like one or two people designing the parts and like two or three people making the parts, there is a limit where if you feed back too much information, the net gain is insignificant. Like if I have to spend, or if, let's say in this example, like someone, one of the boys on the shop floor says, oh, it'll be way easier if you make it like this and design it like this. If that then generates like 2 or 3 hours of design work to save 5 minutes of milling or like 10 minutes of setting up a tool, it makes no sense. And we find ourselves doing things like a hacky way just because we need to move a little bit quicker. But when you extrapolate that out into like a client to vendor relationship, that can be a bit tricky because you want to do things quicker and sometimes you see the opportunity to do it quicker, but you're being incentivized to do them slower.
Yeah. It's kind of like asking a bartender, like, you know, advice on quitting drinking or something. He's not necessarily, like, I'm selling you spindle hours at the end of the day. I'm not going to be like, here's how I could sell you less. Yeah, it's a weird relationship. I think I manage it fairly well. I think a lot of my customers enjoy being able to ask me those questions and know that I give them a pretty straight answer. But, yeah, I mean, sometimes you just have to suss out if what kind of relationship you're dealing with there. The type of buyer you're dealing with as well. Sometimes I'm dealing with a buyer planner type. Sometimes I'm dealing with an engineer who needs parts made. Sometimes I'm dealing with a business owner who needs parts made. And those all react differently in those situations. And learning that, I don't know. I actually kind of enjoy the quoting process and the back and forth anymore. I find it more interesting than like programming.
Thank you all for listening in on episode 19 of the Precision Microcast. It's been a pleasure to talk to you about our precision problems and introduce you to NS. And I hope that you enjoyed spending the time listening in on the podcast, and thank you for spending the time. Adam and I hope to join you in episode 20 shortly, chatting about precision and all things machining related. See you soon. Bye.